In Washington, D.C., it is 72 degrees, mostly cloudy. From WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Afternoon, Washington, D.C., Maryland, Virginia, wherever you are tuned in. You're listening to Taking Action here on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C. I'm honored to have on this afternoon Nancy Drain. She is the executive director of the Access to Justice Commission here in Washington, D.C. We'll be talking about what Access to Justice does and some of the issues surrounding the forthcoming budget that we are expecting the mayor to present to our city council by tomorrow. So make sure to stay tuned here to Taking Action. Welcome, Nancy. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Yes, no, I always think it's important to highlight the people, the organizations that are doing good work for low-income district residents. And so why don't we just start off actually talking about what is Access to Justice? From the little bit of research I've done, I think it starts in 2005. But why don't you share with us, you know, what Access to Justice is and a little bit of the history of it?
Wonderful. Thanks. Yes, I'm the executive director of the District of Columbia Access to Justice Commission. Most states have an Access to Justice Commission, and we all have a similar role in our community to really highlight the role of the civil justice system in assisting the residents in our communities. So when I say civil justice, I mean, first, not criminal justice. So, you know, not the criminal justice court system, but issues that really matter in the daily lives of individuals: housing, family conflict or family instability, employment issues, consumer issues, discrimination. Civil justice is really everything else that you might think of when you think about the legal system. And I like to think about civil justice as really a way to help individuals resolve the problems that they face, to address situations where they feel like they're being treated unfairly, to ensure that they get the government benefits that they feel like they're entitled to. These are everyday problems that are experienced all across the country, but certainly, you know, here in the DMV. And, you know, what we know is that most people who experience these types of problems don't have access to a lawyer. Why is that? Well, they don't have a right to a lawyer. It's not like the criminal justice system where a lawyer will be appointed to you if you can't afford one. There's no right to a lawyer. Lawyers are expensive. And resources for free lawyers, for lawyers who will work on a pro bono basis, meaning, you know, they won't charge you, those resources are limited. And I know we're going to talk about the budget and what we've tried to do to increase resources there, but the reality is that, you know, for many people, they won't get those free legal resources and they'll have to navigate the system alone. So what our Access to Justice Commission was really set up to do when it was established in 2005 was to identify those barriers that people experience in the civil justice system, what's difficult about it, what are obstacles that everyday people face in navigating it, and then to propose solutions. So some of those solutions are funding, you know, support more free lawyers. Some of it is about changing the way the court operates to make it easier for people who don't have a lawyer. There's a wide range of things that we do, but ultimately, you know, we want to make sure that that civil justice system is available to everybody. We want everybody to have some assistance when they're dealing with these issues.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. And it's so important because oftentimes in the work that we do around housing specifically through Empower DC, you know, we realize that housing is one issue that people deal with. Oftentimes people are dealing with many different issues, custody issues, you name it. People are experiencing a multitude of issues that they need help with. And oftentimes the communities that we work with, as you mentioned, don't have the resources to be able to avail themselves of, you know, somebody that can help them navigate the legal process. So, a really important service that you all provide. Talk to us a little bit more about, you know, we had talked about a little about this as we were planning, but, and you alluded to a little earlier, but, you know, the fact that going at it alone, oftentimes, you know, people will, you know, you have that option. You can represent yourself in court, and there's, oftentimes that's like popularized in popular culture. Like, I'm going to go and I'm going to represent myself. But talk to us a little, you know, why is it so important to have legal assistance?
Thank you so much for that question. And I think there are two ways I would go about this question. First, I think we have to acknowledge that the systems that we have set up here are designed for lawyers. They're not designed for regular people. And so, you know, we try to sometimes think about these things at high level. You know, how do we change these systems so that they're more accessible to everybody? But until, you know, we're able to really reform those systems to be more people friendly for everybody, we need to try to equip people who we know are going to go it alone with the tools that they need to be successful. So, you know, some of that is just knowing what the law is and knowing what your rights are. So, housing is a great example. So, you know, a tenant who receives an eviction notice, is often facing that court system alone. Now, there are lots of resources available for those folks. And I know we're going to talk about that later. But, you know, for many people, they end up being, you know, at court by themselves. And often people are not paying their rent because there are housing conditions issues, right? There's repairs that need to be fixed in a unit, infestations, things that the tenant has tried to address with the landlord unsuccessfully. Those are the types of things that a tenant should bring up in the course of a court hearing. You know, when they're before the judge and the landlord is saying, you owe, you know, whatever amount in back rent, it is a defense. It is something that a tenant can raise to say, well, look, you know, there are these housing code violations that need to be addressed. But many tenants don't know that. Even if they do know that, the court process is intimidating. They may not know when to speak or how to speak or what to say. And so having a lawyer to both educate them about what their rights are, but then to really empower them to use the process as it's set up for them and to make sure that the rights that they do have are recognized and are spoken. There's nothing like having legal advice. And you don't necessarily need a lawyer for the life of the case, but even just the opportunity to talk to a lawyer, to get some advice about the hearing that you're about to go into, you know, those are things that can really be transformative. Just another quick example I've been thinking a lot about lately is estate planning. So this is something, it affects everybody. It's not just a low income issue. You know, you want to make sure that you know, when the time comes that you pass, that your wishes are followed in terms of who gets your house or who gets different property that you might own. Many people in the District of Columbia don't have a will. Why? Because they don't know how to draft one. They, you know, don't want to pay a lawyer to do it. But what that means, it means a very complicated legal process often for them if they don't have a will. And you can do a lot to plan ahead if you have legal assistance and avoid some of the complications that can come later. The same could happen in a family law context, right? With a custody dispute. You know, how do you have a neutral person help those two parents, you know, come to an agreement that will be satisfactory to all of them? There's just so many ways that having that advocate or that lawyer or that person to assist makes a huge difference. And just the last point I'll make, you know, just jumping back to the housing example for a second, you know, there have been studies done to look at the impact of having legal representation in eviction matters. And many of those studies have shown not only that people are 6 or 7 times more likely to raise those defenses like housing code violations if they have the assistance of a lawyer, but they are equally more likely to be successful, meaning that they're able to retain their housing. And I know you know a lot about that because of the work that you do. But, you know, it's not just about feeling better, although feeling better about the process is important, but it's also about the real results that you get.
That's right. And I mean, as I understand it, and this is somewhat in a sidebar related, as I understand it, you know, the eviction filings have doubled this year from the number that they were last year. So these type of services are critical because there's so many people who, you know, are unable to avail themselves of the emergency rental assistance program, whose portal just opened yesterday. And I'm hearing there's already some issues with the functionality of that. So the legal support, you know, is something that folks definitely need, you know, to understand the process and to, as you mentioned, have a chance of staying in their homes. So very important. The other piece I wanted to touch upon, and I know the funding is also related to the DC Bar Foundation, but Access to Justice really funds many of the legal service providers' work in the city. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Pretty close to when the commission was founded in 2005, we immediately recognized that one thing the district government was not doing was providing public funding, public support to provide legal services to district residents. You know, we recognize that in many other jurisdictions, there was some sort of public funding program that then, you know, in turn supported nonprofits like Legal Aid or Bread for the City or Legal Counsel for the Elderly to offer free legal services to low-income individuals. And so, you know, one of our first efforts and first successes was to work with the district government, you know, with the mayor at the time and the DC Council to create what's called the Access to Justice Initiative. And what the Access to Justice Initiative is, you know, basically it's a program that is a funding stream of public dollars that support nonprofits that offer free legal services. You know, when the program started, it was, I think, funded at $3 million. In FY24, the fiscal year that we're in now, it's funded at $31 million. It has grown significantly. And, you know, much of that is because of our advocacy and because of the strong support of the DC Council. But I have to say, it's also because of the high quality of legal services that are provided by the grantee organizations who are funded through the program. You know, you mentioned the DC Bar Foundation. They are a private nonprofit organization that receives that public money, and then they in turn grant it out to all of those nonprofits. So there's about 30 plus nonprofit organizations that receive funding from the DC Bar Foundation. But again, those are all public dollars. And the breadth of the legal support that's provided through the initiative is pretty stunning. It's housing, it's child custody, child support, guardianship, education, immigration, public benefits, debt, bankruptcy, you know, name changes, foreclosures. I mean, you name it, the initiative funds that work in some way. And that's not to say the funding is adequate. So we are very grateful for the support that we receive from the district government. But nevertheless, these nonprofits turn away lots of people because they don't have the capacity to help them. But there's no question that the existence of the initiative has allowed for, you know, tens of thousands of district residents every year to get the legal support that they otherwise would not get.
No, thank you for that. And I just to share that, you know, we work along with one of the legal service providers here at Empower DC that receives access to justice grants. And we contract with them to help with connecting them to LTLAN, the Landlord Tenant Legal Assistance Network, which is another critical service here in the district that is letting folks know who have received the notice to appear in court for non-payment of rent, that they have help, right? They can get legal advice, potentially legal representation. You know, so what we do is we go and we get the lists from the courts that are provided by the courts. We knock on folks' doors and remind them, you know, one big thing that we've learned from all the lawyers is show up, right? You know,
right.
It allows people to know you need to show up. Oftentimes people may even have paid the rent, but the case is still an active case in court, so they need to show up. Sometimes people didn't know or, you know, just didn't know how to respond or what to do, so they'll get that very basic information, show up. And then that you have these rights, right? And as you mentioned, a legal service provider can help them think through some defenses such as conditions, you know, maybe the notice was wrong. There's a multitude of ways and tactics that legal service providers can help people who will be appearing in court to do so. And that's all, you know, because of this grant, we're able to cover a lot of ground here in the district to let people know they don't have to go at it alone.
Yeah. And just a couple of points I'd love to make based on what you just shared. So first, the work that you're doing is incredible. And, you know, the opportunity to reach out proactively to tenants is something that we have not always been able to do. And it used to be that, you know, the first time services were really offered to people, or I should say the first time often they met a lawyer was when they showed up at court. And so they didn't have a lot of time to plan together. You know, they were there for the hearing. So they were just meeting that person for the first time. And, you know, increases in that public funding that I just described allowed legal services providers to really change their strategy and say, you know, we can be more successful if we reach people earlier. Like, wouldn't it be great if we were able to address this before they show up to court? Or at least when they are at court, they've had the opportunity to consult with a lawyer. And so the funding that I just described has allowed that work to happen. It was not happening in the way that it is now before. The other thing I just wanted to say, so two things. One, the importance of showing up. You know, there's something in the law called a default. And basically it means if you don't show up, the court can just rule against you because you've basically forfeited your right to participate in the hearing. I'm sort of shorthanding it, but that's what it means in practical terms. And, you know, default rates were really high in eviction cases, and that's not unique to DC. It's, you know, it's a situation that happens across the country. And, you know, I think two things have really changed the trajectory here in DC. One is the work that you all are doing, but also the fact that a lot of these hearings are virtual now.
Yeah.
You know, we're on a Zoom together, you know, recording this conversation, and it's really borne out that people It just makes it more accessible for people to show up. They don't have to wait all day. And, you know, I should give a lot of credit to the court for really changing the way it handled these hearings, to offer them remotely, to, you know, instead of showing up at 8:30 and waiting all day for your case to be heard, now there's a little bit more certainty in terms of the time your hearing's going to be called. You know, all of that has really reduced the number of defaults, which is good for tenants because, of course, they have the right to say their piece. And then lastly, you know, you talked about, you know, errors in the notice or things like that. You know, the district has very tenant-friendly laws. Now, that doesn't mean that tenants don't experience the type of housing stability that they have, you know, across the country. But, you know, the statute and the laws governing eviction have a lot of protections for tenants, but they're worth nothing if they don't know how to exercise them. So that's why having you, you know, they don't need having people like you explain that to them, and also lawyers, is just been a huge game changer.
That's right. That's right. So we've talked a little bit about, you know, some of the kind of nonprofit side of the coin, legal service providers, you know, that aren't like the big firms. But you all do work to encourage some of these big firms in the district to provide pro bono help, which is, you know, an added value to the whole, you know, legal service environment. Talk to us a little bit about the pro bono work.
Yeah.
And unpack what that means for folks. Just in case they don't know.
Yeah, no, it's I'm so glad you raised that, because that's, you know, it makes a huge difference. So, you know, no surprise, DC is probably the lawyer capital of the world. We've got lots of lawyers here in DC, and a lot of them work at big firms or work at the federal government, or they could work at small firms too. But, you know, the point is we have a lot of lawyers here available to us, and, you know, many of them, you know, work for corporate clients or business clients. You know, they don't do this type of legal services or public interest work every day. But they are a resource that we really need to tap into, because, you know, there's a professional obligation for lawyers to use their license to help those who need help, who can't afford legal representation. It's actually in our rules of professional conduct that we have an obligation to volunteer and to support legal services. So, you know, so we have, you know, hundreds and thousands of lawyers in the District of Columbia who every year volunteer hours to represent low-income people. And it's a huge benefit, and you know, it really expands the reach of legal services. You know, I think what's important to know about it is, one, that it's this resource that we need to make sure that we're tapping into, and we really emphasize, you know, with these firms that, you know, they're part of the DC community, and so this is part of their how they can sort of give back to the community and feel a part of the District of Columbia. But in order for them to volunteer, they need these legal services organizations who will train them, who will mentor them, answer questions they may have, you know, find the cases that would be a good match for them. And, you know, when we talk about the Access to Justice Initiative and this funding for legal services organizations, you know, one of the pitches that we make to the DC Council is that, you know, by funding these legal services organizations, you're actually leveraging all sorts of other resources in the community. Because, you know, the bottom line is that if you don't have a legal aide who's willing to screen those cases and train pro bono volunteers, they might not take on these cases because they won't feel like they're able to. You know, they want to do a good job. They want to be competent. And so, you know, having a well-resourced legal services community means that they can devote the time to train and you know, mentor these pro bono attorneys. And I want to give a special shout out to federal government attorneys. You know, we have a lot of, you know, federal government attorneys, you know, attorneys who are employed by the U.S. government, and they offer hundreds, if not thousands, of hours every year to support our low-income district neighbors. It's been around for a long time. There's been really strong leadership at the Department of Justice to promote pro bono, but it's a a huge benefit and something I think we uniquely enjoy here just because we have so many government lawyers here in the district.
Yeah, no, so important. I know we've benefited from working with some of the bigger firms to help the nonprofit legal providers that we work with move individual cases, larger cases forward. So definitely a big help here in the district. So I wanted to ask you, because I've been just searching your website a little bit, and I definitely want to get into some of the budget stuff that we talked about. But what was also interesting to me is the reports that you all put together. There seem to be a couple of great reports. Just talk to us briefly about those reports that you all have up on your website.
Yeah. So thank you so much for asking about that. You know, part of what we have tried to do as an organization is to sort of step back and not only report on the state of things in the district, but also to make recommendations for things that we think could improve or strengthen our civil justice system. And, you know, there's a lot of different stakeholders in the district. You know, there's a lot of legal services organizations, there's pro bono attorneys, there's the court. You know, we have this, I think, unique ability to sort of go a little bit higher level and see all of these stakeholders and how they work together in order, you know, to make some suggestions for systems change. So over the years, we've done several reports that we call legal needs reports that really sort of assess the state of civil justice in the district. So we did one in 2008, and then we did a second one that was published in December 2019. And basically what they do is they sort of give a sense of, you know, what are the civil legal issues that people are experiencing or being challenged by in the district? What are people doing about it? So what are some things that are working? So knocking on doors, you know, to talk to tenants, that's working in terms of making a difference on housing cases, for example. Really trying to highlight the types of interventions that are working, but also describing the real challenges, you know, and you know, one of the, when I think about our 2019 report, one of the headlines, you know, was that we really hadn't made a dent in poverty here in the district. You know, we took, it wasn't just civil legal justice. We also looked at demographic data, and, you know, the poverty numbers really hadn't changed a lot over that 10-year time period. And so, you know, people who are living in poverty are much more likely to experience civil justice issues. And so, you know, we saw those issues really persistent. You know, we didn't see a lot of improvement in terms of the likelihood that someone would experience a civil justice problem. But we did some, you know, see some interventions that were really successful, you know, public funding, of course, being one of them, but also, you know, policy advocacy. And we talked in particular, again, in the housing context, about efforts to sort of bring together the Office of the Attorney General and private law firms and legal services organizations and tenant groups to identify, let's say, buildings that were particularly problematic or landlords who were particularly problematic, or exercising rights like the Tenant Opportunity to Purchase Act, you know, that give tenants some choices and some, you know, some opportunities. So, you know, those kinds of sort of big picture efforts are different than representing an individual tenant. But to us, they were as important in terms of addressing some of these systemic challenges that we faced. So the report is long, but I think it does a really nice job of sort of capturing some of the specific civil justice areas and the work that was happening. And then, you know, finally, we made some recommendations. And in that 2019 report, you know, we were really focused, honestly, on those people who didn't get help, you know, sort of going back to our original original conversation about, you know, what it means to navigate these systems alone. You know, we thought that the district really needed to take a look at how we're supporting those people that don't get lawyers, sort of knowing that it would be virtually impossible to guarantee a lawyer for everyone. So, you know, fast forward to now, you know, a lot of the work that we're doing is in that self-help area. You know, we're shortly will be coming out with a report and some recommendations to the legal community on how we can make sure we have better strengthened legal information available to community members that they can really use and that's accessible to them, you know, that doesn't have a lot of legalese that, you know, even some lawyers wouldn't understand, you know, that's simple and straightforward and manageable that people can really use it. But yeah, so, and we really see that as part of our mission to really study what's happening and to share that with people in our community.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. I mean, for organizations like ours, like mine, that does this work, you know, anything that we can do to learn more about the legal process. And as you mentioned, it not being kind of an overwhelming thing, important for us. Folks, you are tuned in to Taking Action here on WPFW 89.3 FM. We are having a discussion with Nancy Drain. She's the executive director of the Access to Justice Commission. We've been talking a little bit about the work that they do, a little bit about the history. One thing that I forgot to mention or ask about is, you know, what is the council, the city council's role in all of this? I had shared with you, I was in a meeting with a council member and he spoke so highly about the program. But talk to us a little bit the council's role in all of this work.
Yeah, a very good and timely question. So, you know, as I said before, the council actually created the Access to Justice Initiative, the public funding program. So we would, you know, the program would be nowhere without the council. But, you know, of course, since that time, you know, the council, you know, this time of year has an opportunity to look at the mayor's proposed budget and, you know, to make some decisions about how to fund particular programs, you know, and so, you know, I think two things I would highlight about the council's role. One, you know, in 2018, which is now a little while ago, you know, the council recognized that we just really weren't doing enough as a community on housing and particularly legal services and housing. And when I say not doing enough, I mean we needed more resources to be able to help people. And so the council actually created the program that you know are a part of now. It's called the Civil Legal Council Projects Program. It's a bit of a mouthful, but basically, you know, it ensures that district residents can receive support in eviction related proceedings. But, you know, when the council created that program, it basically doubled the budget of the program. And, you know, Councilmember McDuffie sort of started the conversation around this, and then Councilmember Allen, when he was the chair of the Judiciary Committee, sort of took us across the finish line in terms of that program. You know, but now, you know, we really rely on the council to ensure that we have appropriate funding for the program. We the commission will, we always engage with the mayor's team. You know, we submit a budget request to them asking for what we think we need, which is never enough, but, you know, sort of what we think reasonably we can ask for. But then at the end of the day, the budget goes to the council. So, we have, you know, honestly been really lucky that the council has recognized the importance of this program. You know, the chairman always talks about this program as one of, he thinks, the most effective programs in terms of getting results for district residents. You know, not to disparage other programs, he just sees this as a very effective program. You know, and last year we had every council member talk during the budget process about why this program was important. And, you know, that was essential last year because we faced a cut from a significant cut from the mayor last year. And, you know, I think in fairness to the mayor, you know, the program enjoyed significant increases over the past several years. You know, those increases were all commensurate with the need. You know, it's not like these were unreasonable increases, but, you know, there were significant increases. So last year, The mayor cut some of those increases, you know, similar to some other programs that were cut back to, you know, so-called pre-pandemic levels. But we were looking at a 60% cut in the program budget. And, you know, for a program like ours, where, you know, all of the money goes to support staff, you know, lawyers and other staff were on the ground. It's not, you know, the only consequence of a budget cut like that would be less people served and less staff in the community helping them. So, you know, so we faced that 60% cut, but because of, you know, the advocacy of our community who really spoke up about the importance of the program, and because of the support of the council, you know, we were able to recover that that cut and, you know, got back to level funding. So, you know, we sort of had level funding from FY23 to FY24. So, which was a great, you know, which a great success for us, and, you know, and really was a testament to the support that we see at the council.
Yeah, no, so important, and kind of setting it up for what's to come. As I mentioned, tomorrow we are expecting that the mayor will deliver her budget to the council. It's actually been delayed. It was supposed to have been delivered 2 weeks ago, I believe.
Yeah.
But there's been, you know, there's, if people are following the budget, there's been a little bit of drama around, you know, how it moving forward with the CFO, and that's a whole other show. But we are expecting potentially a lot of cuts across the board, not just with this program. You know, and I think we've talked a little bit about what we can infer from the conversation we've been having, why it's so important. But, you know, I think it's important for folks to hear why, again, why funding this program is so important.
Yeah. Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think that the mayor and the chairman of the council have really been preparing the community for a difficult budget. You know, some of that is because of the so-called drama you mentioned, but, you know, even before that, we were preparing ourselves for a difficult budget. So, so we will see tomorrow what we're facing, but, you know, but that's sort of what we're expecting. So, you know, thinking about, I mean, I just think back to last year and, you know, how our partners responded, and it was with grave concern, you know, and during the budget oversight process last year, you know, organizations like Legal Aid were saying, look, you know, this is a significant percentage of our budget. This is the number of staff who are funded by this program. These are the number of clients that we help through this funding. This is what a 60% cut to all of that means to us. You know, we had partners in the community who rely on lawyers, you know, medical, you know, there are these really great medical legal partnerships where lawyers are co-located at medical clinics. You know, one of our commissioners is the CEO of AmeriHealth, and she talks about how powerful it is to have a lawyer part of the medical team. So if there's sort of a legal issue that's impacting a patient's health, you know, housing being the perfect example of that, you know, environmental hazards in the home, she has a lawyer right there to partner with to try to address those issues. And there are huge cost savings, by the way, with that, you know, saved medical expenses for that child who doesn't have to go back to the doctor. But, you know, regardless, we had people like that talking about the consequences of a cut. And, you know, and I think the other thing that really sort of was brought together last year that I expect will be brought together again this year is the sort of the interrelationship with all of these government programs that may be cut. So we keep talking about housing, but it's a good example. Emergency rental assistance. So last year, you know, the mayor proposed a really significant cut to ERAP, to the emergency rental assistance. Again, it was going back to sort of pre-pandemic funding levels. You know, at the same time, there was this cut to legal services. Well, obviously, if there's less rental assistance available to people, they are more at risk of being evicted. You know, rental assistance is the biggest tool to help people keep people housed. I mean, far above lawyers, you know, lawyers are helpful, but, you know, rental assistance is really incredibly helpful. And so we were sort of saying to the council, look, like, we're going to have less rental assistance and now we're going to have less access to lawyers. You know, it's this like inverse relationship in terms of investments in the community. And so, you know, we'll see what the mayor proposes and we'll see what the council is able to do to balance all of those needs. You know, I don't envy them. There's going to be a lot of really valuable programs that I think are going to be part of the conversation. But, you know, we just know the difference that it's going to make for the clients that rely on these programs if they're frankly not available. So, you know, we last year we did a lot of organizing with people like you and others to really make sure the council understood the breadth of the program and why cuts would make such a difference. So we're prepared to do that again this year, and would be happy not to, but we're sort of expecting that we're going to have a similar budget scenario as last year. But we'll know. There's been a lot of anticipation. We'll know tomorrow sort of what we're facing.
Yeah, we're hoping to do a budget debrief of sorts here on the show.
Oh, great.
In the coming week, you know, just to talk about what's happening. But yeah, you know, as you mentioned, I was part of some of those efforts last year. And what was really impactful for me were the clients, right? The people that depend on the services, talking about how, you know, I couldn't have done X, whatever the issue was that they were dealing with, without the support, the legal support.
Yeah.
And, you know, and not just the direct legal support, but the programmatic support that these funds provide, such as tenant support specialists who help people navigate the ERAP process, you know, in general, knowing what their rights are, what other public benefits there may be out there to offset them not being able to get funding from ERAP, as you mentioned. So very critical. And I think that, you know, that really does move at the end of the day. The decision makers is hearing how people depend on these services. Nancy, if folks want to, and I forgot to mention this, but if folks have questions or any comments, if you've you know, benefited, been a part of Access to Justice or any of the programs associated with them, feel free to give us a call, 202-588-0893. Once again, that's 202-588-0893. But if folks want to know more and learn more about the programs that you all offer, you know, how can they keep in touch with you all?
Yeah. So, you know, the first thing they can do is go to our website. It's dcaccesstojustice.org. dcaccesstojustice.org. It's a bit of a mouthful. But there's more information about us, you know, who our commissioners are. You know, we have a very small staff, but then we have a 25 commissioners who are appointed by the DC Court of Appeals to really champion the work that we do. They're all incredible people in their own right, so that we're lucky to have. And then we do have a page that's dedicated to the public funding work that we're doing. And, you know, we'll do our best to get updates and advocacy materials and all of that onto our website. The website also has my contact information, so I'm always happy to talk to people about our work, but particularly if folks are interested in partnering with us on this advocacy effort or any other effort, would love to be in touch. And, you know, I think I said this at the beginning, but we often see ourselves in a position as a convener. So, you know, a lot of times I'll talk to someone and find out they're working on something and say, oh, I should introduce them to so-and-so because they're working on something similar. So, you know, I love it when people reach out to me to tell me work that they're doing. So, you know, that's a way, you know, where, you know, during budget season, we try to be more active on X. So, you know, we'll share updates and things on that platform as well. We're a pretty low tech organization. Like I said, we're, you know, a teeny tiny nonprofit. You know, we're independent, so we're not part of the court or part of the bar. We're an independent nonprofit. You know, we don't have the fanciest materials, but we're pretty effective with the resources that we have. So those would be good places to go.
That's right. No, thank you so much for sharing that. And as we begin to close, you know, I think I always like to ask organizational leaders and just organizations in general, and we'll put aside kind of the budget realities that are taking place. But how do you see the commission growing? What, you know, do you all just want to amplify what you do? Or is there anything that you all think is also important as you mentioned, you know, look at what's happening, evaluate what's happening and try to come up with solutions?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, as I just said, you know, we're sort of small but mighty, and you know, we rely on donations, like many other nonprofits, just to be able to support the staff that we have. So, you know, we're always talking about ways that we could increase our budget so that we can have more staff members to be able to do more. And when I say do more, you know, there's just so much to do, you know. So, you know, that self-help piece, legal information, we really need more focused effort on that in the community. There are so many exciting things happening across the country in the civil justice area. Like, how does AI fit into how we deliver legal services? How do we better partner with non-lawyers so that they can help people resolve legal issues? How do we change the way our court systems work? You know, there's just so much happening. And I think we often feel like we're playing catch up because there's so much going on. So I think we really want the District of Columbia to be a place where some of these innovative ideas are being embraced and utilized. But because we're such a have sort of a complicated ecosystem, you know, it takes organizations like us to sort of bring people together to move forward on some of these ideas. So I think for us, the sky's the limit. You know, we just need to figure out how we best prioritize our time and capacity to get this work done. And, you know, times like this, you know, we're focused a lot on budget advocacy. That's kind of the work that we're doing over the next month or so. So, you know, would be great not to have to do this every year, but you know, we're totally happy to do it. And it's really important.
That's right. Well, Nancy, I want to thank you so much for the work that you do. As you mentioned, you know, you're a small organization, but doing a lot of meaningful and powerful work here in the district. That I, as you know, I'll just, you know, say it again. It's so important that we have these services provided. You know, as a grassroots organization, you know, our work really is out there to get people motivated and involved in you know, the civil work that we've been talking about. But you know, we depend on the partnership with legal service providers. We couldn't do it without you all. So, you know, just saying thank you for the work that you do and just putting it out there that it is so important to keep these type of services funded, especially as we are expecting, you know, some potential cuts in the funding.
Yeah, and just if I can say one other quick thing, I mean, I think it's really important for the listeners who are DC residents to reach out to their council members and talk about the importance of this work. If you have received services from this program, reach out to your council member and tell them why it's so important. You know, we can do that, but there's nothing like hearing directly from DC residents who have benefited from these programs. And, you know, council members are going to be hearing from a lot of people on a lot of issues, and we want to make sure that this program is something that they've got top of mind during the budget process. So we really encourage professionals and community members, you know, reach out to the council during this budget season.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. Wishing all the best, and I'm sure we'll be in contact and hopefully have you back on in the near future to talk about all the good work y'all are doing.
Would love that, and really am grateful for all your partnership on this work and the invitation.
Oh, no problem at all. Thank you so much, Nancy. Folks, you have been tuned in to Taking Action here on WPFW. I want to let folks know a couple of things that are coming up that will be important, especially related to the budget. That will be having over the next couple of days. I want to let folks know, especially public housing residents, that on this coming Wednesday, tomorrow, we are having a training to prepare ourselves for the upcoming budget hearing for DCHA. As I mentioned, you know, there's been some back and forth with the budget and the day it was supposed to be released. So that has changed, actually, the calendar, the hearing calendar. So some of the hearings have been changed and have shifted. So if you were planning and participating in any of those, make sure to take a look and see that you have the correct date for any of the hearings you may be interested in. You know, we're keeping an eye on several of them. This Friday, actually, we'll be testifying at the Department of Human Services, where we'll be talking about the importance of funding the Emergency Rental Assistance Program. Next week, we'll be attending the DC Housing Authority's budget hearing at the City Council, but we are having a virtual prep session tomorrow, Wednesday night. If folks are interested, if you're a public housing resident and you're interested in attending, or you work with public housing residents and are interested in giving testimony and developing, you know, some talking points for that, please feel free to reach out to me. You can email me at daniel@empowerdc.org. Once again, that's daniel@empowerdc.org. I can also be reached at 202-731-8634. As I mentioned earlier, the mayor is planning on, or we're expecting rather, that the mayor will release her budget tomorrow, where we'll obviously get a better sense of what is being funded, what is being cut, and then prepare ourselves to respond to that. Tomorrow there will be a press conference and a rally in front of the Wilson Building. It's being brought to you by the Fair Budget Coalition and the People's Press Conference and Rally, which is co-sponsored by the Fair Budget Coalition and Just Recovery DC. Will be in front of the Wilson Building, you know, with a response and some of the suggestions we have for, you know, keeping a fair budget and funding a fair budget that doesn't cut, you know, necessary services. As we alluded to in the conversation we were having with Nancy, you know, many of the programs that we feel are very important, such as ERAP, the mayor has now mentioned that she wants to get back to pre-pandemic funding, which means, you know, a lot less money in a program like that than at the levels it's currently funded at. So an important event tomorrow to bring to attention that, you know, we should not be balancing this budget on the backs of poor low-income people here in the district. So please make sure to join us. Once again, if you have any questions about the budget, want to get involved in some advocacy, always feel free to reach out to us here at Empower DC. Once again, my email is daniel@empowerdc, and my phone number is 202-731-8634. Make sure to stay tuned in just a couple of minutes. You've got COVID Race and Democracy. You've got the news coming up in just a couple of seconds. As always, thank you so much for tuning in. We will catch you next Tuesday. Peace, everyone.
Dori Ladner was a courageous civil rights activist. Her legacy lives on every time we choose to confront injustice. Dori Ladner's funeral will be held this Saturday, April 13th, at Shiloh Baptist Church, 1500 9th Street, Northwest DC, at 11 a.m. All are welcome to come and bid farewell to this icon of the civil rights movement. WPFW extends condolences to the family of Dori Ladner. ¶¶
The search process for WPFW's next general manager is underway. Successful management searches begin by having conversations with stakeholders to clarify and document expectations for future management. Therefore, WPFW's local station board is inviting all stakeholders to participate in our online survey. To complete the survey, please click the link on WPFW's website. Because we need your input, the deadline for the survey has been extended to Friday, April 12, 2024. Thank you.
Born of Haitian descent, Jerry Paris, WPFW's general manager, is moving on to retirement. On April 14th, from 3 p.m. until 7 p.m., we will celebrate his departure at the VIP Room, 6201 3rd Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., with Island Flair, steel drums, a DJ, and food from the islands. That's April 14th from 3 p.m. until 7 p.m. For more information and tickets, call 202-368-4081 or visit Eventbrite and search for Jerry Paris Retirement. Seating is limited.
Good afternoon. For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Darnia Samuels. Here are some headlines for this hour. On November 30th, 2021, 15-year-old Ethan Crumbly pulled a handgun from his backpack and began shooting at his school, Oxford High in Michigan. He killed four students. Ethan, who's now 17, is serving a life sentence for murder and other crimes. Today, though, his parents, James and Jennifer Crumbly, were each sentenced to at least 10 years in prison for failing to take steps that could have prevented that 2021 shooting. The Crumblys are the first parents convicted in a United States mass school shooting, having been found guilty of involuntary manslaughter after prosecutors presented evidence of an unsecured gun at their home and indifference toward their teenage son's mental health. Before the shooting took place, Ethan Crumbly drew dark images of a gun, a bullet, and a wounded man on a math assignment, accompanied by despondent phrases. Later that day, he carried out the deadly shooting. In the early morning hours of March 26, a huge container ship lost power and careened into Baltimore's Francis Scott Key Bridge, causing most of the bridge to collapse into the Patapsco River, which led to the deaths of six construction workers, namely Miguel Luna, Dorleon Cabrera, Alejandro Hernandez Fuentes, Jose Minor Lopez, Maynard Suazo Sandoval, and his brother Carlos Suazo Sandoval. To honor those victims, local residents in Curtis Bay, Maryland, held a vigil over the weekend, and a mural was placed near Fort Armistead Road, the closest that residents could get to the collapsed site. The mural features the names of the six construction workers, along with hard hats, work boots, and the flags of those men's native countries. Additionally, the Baltimore Orioles and Baltimore Ravens have together donated $10 million to the Baltimore Community Foundation's Key Bridge Emergency Fund. And President Joe Biden, who toured the remains of the collapsed bridge, told the city of Baltimore, "Your nation has your back." To your local news, the New York State Senate passed a series of legislation today aimed at protecting animals and the sale and treatment of pets. If enacted into law, the bills would do many things, including require that any landlords or lessors inspect the property for any abandoned animals within 3 days of a property being vacated and notify the proper authorities, add certain wild or exotic animals to the list of non-companion animals and prohibit such animals from being imported, sold, or owned, and enhance New York's animal cruelty laws to further deter individuals from engaging in animal fighting and other harmful practices. Commenting on these measures, Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins said in a statement, and I quote, "It's our responsibility to protect and defend the voiceless, and that includes our cherished pets and animals," end quote. To the D.C. area, D.C. has opened its real-time crime center, which Police Chief Pamela Smith calls the new epicenter for how D.C. police respond to crime and investigate cases. The center is a hub for technology like shot spotters, license plate readers, traffic cameras, and security cameras funneled through a command center at police headquarters. Leaders want residents and businesses in D.C. to register their security cameras with police. By registering, residents and businesses are not giving police access to their footage, but are letting them know the location of the camera. So if a crime happens nearby, police can ask for the camera to be checked. In today's weather, it's currently about 73 degrees in New York and 78 degrees in D.C. That's all for your headline news this hour. For WPFW Washington and WBAI.